Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Helles Foundation and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Hello, and welcome to The Reading Life, your weekly look at the Louisiana literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, we'll preview the New Orleans Book Festival at Tulane University by looking back at interviews with festival writers. Among them, Walter Isaacson, Imani Perry, Jonathan Eig, Sarah Broom, Jessamine Ward, Richard Ford, and Eddie Glaude. This week, the New Orleans Book Festival at Tulane University gets underway Thursday, March 14th and runs through March 16th. Jam-packed with great authors gathered for fascinating discussions, it's all free. Check out bookfest.tulane.edu for the complete schedule. We thought we'd revisit some of our conversations with festival authors to give you an idea of what's in store. Walter Isaacson, festival co-founder with Cheryl Landrieu, appears with documentary filmmaker Ken Burns to talk about his best-selling biography, Leonardo da Vinci, and Burns' forthcoming film, Leonardo, set to air in November of 1924. There will be a preview of that documentary Saturday, March 16th. When we talked with Isaacson about the book, he described how he was seduced by da Vinci's notebooks.
When I saw Leonardo's notebooks, I mean, most people have written about Leonardo or art critics, and so they base it on the, 12 or so great painting masterpieces. But when I started running across and then searching out the notebooks that Leonardo left behind, I realized there was more than 7,000 pages, some of them in Florence and Milan or Paris or Madrid or Windsor Castle, and even in Bill Gates' home in Seattle. And I realized that I could see a mind that was dancing with nature, that was dancing with imagination as I just turned page after page of his notebooks. And so that's what convinced me to write the book. And the book is based partly on just looking at his notebooks.
And I love that this kind of reinvigorated your love of paper as a technology.
When I was doing Steve Jobs, we were trying to find his emails from the 1990s when he worked at Next Computer. And even with all of his techies, he couldn't retrieve some of the emails from his Next Computer operating system. But 500 years after Leonardo died, we're still able to look at the paper that he wrote on. So it reminded me, paper's a really good technology. It's good for the storage and retrieval of information.
Tulane professor Jessamine Ward also appears at the festival and talks about Let Us Descend, her powerful new depiction of the slavery era. Now, Let Us Descend is the story of a young woman from North Carolina who's sold into slavery here in Louisiana. And getting to New Orleans is a substantial part of the story, describing the ways slaves walked across land and swam or struggled across water, tied to each other. And talk about writing the grim physical reality of that. That must have been exhausting to imagine and recreate. When I think of someone walking barefoot for so long, it just does me in.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it was emotional. It's, one of the things that I wanted to do when I wrote about, because the main character's name is Annis, so she's this young enslaved woman, and she takes this journey from the Carolinas to New Orleans. And so one of the things that I wanted to do is I wanted to crowd the reader into her experience, right? So and using some strong sensory details and imagery over and over and over again in order to do that. And I realized while I was writing, the rough draft, and then afterwards when I would go back in and I would revise, that it was taxing, right? So mm-hmm. Sink back in to that experience again with Annis in the pages. But I don't know. I just part of the reason that I wanted to do it is because I feel like it's very easy for us to remove ourselves from that experience and from that history, and to sort of think about enslaved people as being just very distant from us and very separate from us. So I was hoping, right, that like paying attention to the details and making, you know, Annis's journey feel like a lived experience, that that would move us closer, right, to Annis and to that experience, and enable us to feel in part like we've lived it, like we've been mm-hmm. close to that exhaustion, we've been close to that terror, we've been close to that pain.
This is really a new way of seeing New Orleans in fiction. And I wonder how much of it you knew and how much you had to research. I mean, we talk about the gritty, raw reality of slavery here and the way free people of color do not acknowledge the enslaved, for example. That's one thing Annis noticed, of course, quite painfully. And in general, the horrible treatment. But how much did you have to read and research to go back and recreate that?
I researched all of it because when I began working on Let Us Descend, I realized that I knew nothing about, you know, American chattel slavery in general, and specifically, you know, what New Orleans was like during that time when slavery was such an integral part of the city. Like, I knew nothing about any of it. And so I actually spent 2 years researching and just reading book after book after book, mm-hmm. and like stumbling from one book to another. I should have availed myself of the, you know, expertise of librarians, but unfortunately I did not. Just like read and read and read. And, it took a lot of reading for me to get to a place where I felt comfortable with like crafting a version of the city, you know, what it might have been like back then. You know, actually, that detail about the free people of color sort of ignoring the enslaved, that one was something. I think that was something that was born of my imagination. You know, mm-hmm. I did do some reading, but I think that in that moment, it sort of felt right for mm-hmm. them, for the free people of color, to ignore the enslaved, because it seemed like that would be one of the only ways that they could continue to operate in the world.
Yeah.
You know, pseudo free people at the same time that the enslaved were moving through that world. It just seemed right.
Former New Orleanian Jonathan Eig will be on hand to talk about his powerful biography of Martin Luther King, King, A Life. He talks about the origin of his book and how King and King's wife Coretta inspired him. Now, what a book. I mean, you really give readers, as they say, the man in full.
Well, that was the goal. You know, I felt like over the years that we've seen King turned into a monument and a national holiday, we've watered down the story. We've lost sight of him as a human being. So my very first instinct was really, you know, could I write a book that returned him to humanity and made us feel like we were with him and made us cry when we lost him, and try to just give us something more intimate than at least what I've grown up with in my image of King over the years.
Well, he's just one of those figures that deserves a new biography from time to time, you know, generational almost. But you had access to some materials that were previously unavailable. So talk a little bit about the use you made of those writings and recordings.
40 years now since the last King biography, so a lot of time had gone by. A lot of new FBI materials had surfaced, and the FBI continues to release new material from their surveillance of King, from recordings that were made of his home phone, his office phone, and the phones of his associates. But in addition to that, I found archival materials that King himself kept. I found the SCLC's personal, official archivist, I should say, L.D. Reddick, his papers were at the Schomburg Library in Harlem. I found recordings that Coretta made when she was working on her very first book right after King's assassination. I found an unpublished memoir written by King's father. So many things, I could go on and on. So, you know, the more I dug, the more I found.
So what was it like to spend all those hours listening to Coretta Scott King's voice? I know it was really important to you to get her right in this book.
Yeah, you know, she was overlooked throughout much of her life, and she's been overlooked throughout history, too, because And some of it's the fault of the times. Women were relegated to roles of support at the time, and they weren't given much of a chance to step up as leaders. Partly also was the fact that she was fairly humble and shy and didn't really seek attention. And I think that spending that time listening to her recordings, and this is just months after her husband's assassination, listening to her talking about her own life, her own career, her own feelings, was incredibly moving for me, because the thing that really came across to me was that she had to sort of accept this secondary role over and over again, even though what really attracted Martin to her in the first place was her activism, her mm-hmm. courage, her insistence on fighting for rights. She was more of an activist than he was when they met, and that really attracted him.
Well, there was one time when he was going off to make a speech and she was staying home with the kids and said, "Be sure somebody records it so I can hear it." That was great.
Yeah, and that's the only reason we have a recording of his first really important speech in Montgomery at the start of the bus boycott. It's because Coretta had to stay home with the baby. Mm-hmm. And she said, "Here, take this tape recorder."
Richard Ford will talk about his 14th work of fiction, Be Mine, the final volume in his Frank Bascom series. And he'll talk about how happy he is to be back in New Orleans. So happy you're back in New Orleans. How is that?
Well, I guess I think everybody, whether you've been here or not, you live the lyrics of that song. Do you know what it means to miss New Orleans?
Yeah.
And I just missed it, 20 years away in Maine. I just missed it. And I was a kid here in 1945. I have a picture of my parents holding me on
right.
VJ Day in Lake Pontchartrain. My father used to keep a room in the Mont Lyon. And when he had to do his Evangeline country work, mm-hmm. which is to say over in the, down the river parishes and across the Chafly, we would come down here with him and stay in the Mont Lyon. And he would go to Houma, and he'd go to Villeplate, and he'd go to all those little towns.
And he'd go to the Carousel Bar.
He did. He went to the Carousel Bar.
You have a great story about the Carousel Bar.
Well, I was just a little boy. I was probably 5 or 6, so I don't know if I remember it or did my mother tell me. And we were waiting for my father, and finally we realized he was in the bar. And we went into the bar, and my father was sitting there, and he said to my mother, "Edna," he said, I'm drunk, he said. And she said, "Well, Carol, why do you think that?" He said, "Because when I came in here and I sat down," he said, "I swear to God, I thought I was on the other side of the room." It must have happened to 1,000 million people.
Of course.
We lived there, basically. And I have a great relationship with the hotel. And
of course. You're part of the reason they're a literary landmark.
Well, me and Tennessee Williams and Eudora Welty and a few other people.
Princeton professor Eddie Glaude's first appearance at the book festival was canceled due to the pandemic, but he still has much to say about the topic of his most recent book, the writer James Baldwin.
My journey with James Baldwin has been a complicated one. I really didn't start reading him seriously until graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
And even then it was kind of fraught and vexed, because I knew that Baldwin was going to ask something of me that I wasn't quite ready for. So when I first got to graduate school, I say this in the book, that I only wanted to read, I was reading primarily Ralph Ellison because I thought his mask fit perfectly,
Right.
That there was something about his elegance and sophistication that held people off, kept people at a distance. But Jimmy, when you read him, there was always this kind of unsettling quality that he was shifting the ground beneath your feet, trying to force you to look at, in some ways, the ugliness that has shaped you, the messiness of your life, your mm-hmm. interior life, and how it evidences itself in the world that you inhabit. So, when I finally turned to him, it was this kind of, okay, let me just step into this storm and, the examined life. As
yes, I'm ready now.
I think it's time. And so it's been this amazing kind of journey of thinking about the personal, thinking about autobiography and the political and the ethical and the democratic all at once, And so it's been an amazing journey.
Memoirist Sarah Broom will take part in a panel called Crescent City Stories, drawing from the rich store of memories of family life and The Yellow House, a memoir.
It feels right in a way, the timing of it, because I feel that I started writing this book when I left the house, which was in 1997 for college. I was writing about the house itself. Mm-hmm. And it's been such a journey to see the book evolve, to become about more than the physical structure, to become about family and the city of New Orleans and the trickiness and thorniness of place and what it means to feel rooted.
Talk about the tangled history of your family in New Orleans East. Because you come from this large, complicated family, and you're the baby.
I am.
So that's a privileged position in many ways.
That's interesting that you think of it that way.
I'm the oldest.
Okay, yeah. People have brought that up. They've said, well, that's a good position because then you know more in a way. I always felt that it was a dangerous position to be in, to be telling the history. Because everyone is telling you in many ways when you're the baby, the history of who you are. Mm-hmm. My siblings are saying, before you were here, this is what the world was like. I felt very transgressive in a way to sort of take on the position in this big clan with so many voices and very loud voices. You know, no, there are only a few whisperers in my family. So this was quite an undertaking. And to think about the ways in which our stories were so different from each other, you know, the big moment for me was talking to my sister Deborah and saying, in an interview, and saying, okay, tell me about the Yellow House. And she said, what Yellow House? The house I knew was green.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So the moment you start to understand that everyone has different stories about this one singular place.
And for 12 of you, 12 kids.
12, right.
That's a lot of points of view.
Sure. I mean, that creates a kind of tension, or created a kind of tension for me as a writer, mm-hmm. because I wanted to, in a way, let people speak for themselves and have a say. But the point, if I'm going to write, I have to claim my own story and my own point of view, and I have to hold on to that. So that was tricky.
Now, so much of this book is about home. And I remember after Katrina, I noticed that people said home differently, the word. Mm. They said it a little more softly with a slightly longer O. You know, they lavished that word with affection, mm-hmm. home. And you've written so much about the Yellow House, mm-hmm. as a source of shame, as mm-hmm. a source of family kind of cohesiveness. Mm-hmm. And then after Katrina, to have it gone, mm-hmm. just to have it demolished.
Sure.
I can't even imagine. And then to fight the road home battle for how many years? 11?
Yeah, for 11 years. You know, this is so hard. This is the heart of it all, really, because the thing I always remind myself is that my mother bought this house when she was 18, 19 years old with every cent she had. It was her dream. It was a place she loved. It was a place she built up. It was a place she raised her 12 children in. The house was a repository for us. It was the witness to our lives. When I see any house missing from any landscape, whether it's in New Orleans, whether it's in Detroit, whether it's in Cambodia, something is shaken in me. Because very, very quickly, I think about the stories that that house contained. I think about the family who's been displaced from that house. And so for me, that was really the work to start to think about what happens to all of us when these places we know and these places we love are suddenly gone, even if they're still there and transfigured, but mm-hmm. gone in some sort of way.
Amani Perry will be one of the great Southern voices on hand next weekend in our conversation about South to America, a journey below the Mason-Dixon to understand the soul of a nation. She talked about her Southern roots and her ties to New Orleans.
I am in some ways an exile. I was born in Alabama. It has always been the place that I feel most deeply connected to, and yet also I've been aware, as I've lived outside of the South for most of my life, of how misunderstood and mischaracterized I think the region has been, especially with respect to how central it is to the formation of our country, you know, for better and worse. And so for me, you know, it felt like the book I wanted to write that would feel like I had, I don't know, repaid all of the bounty that I'd been given. My mother was a novice in the Sisters of the Holy Family, Order of Nuns, the second oldest order of Black nuns in the United States, that was founded in New Orleans pre-Civil War and has been in service continuously. My godmother used to be Vicar Superior there and is still with the order. And then my biological father, who did not raise me, was born to a woman from New Orleans. I had great-grands who lived on 1312 Joliet in New Orleans. And but so you know, I say this thing about, like, you know, one of the things that was fascinating to me was to realize that why my mother cooked differently than other members of my family, which I never fully processed until I realized, oh, well, she was a late adolescent in New Orleans, right? So she cooked with the Trinity. Mm-hmm. And so I've always felt a kind of connectedness through family, both sort of in a phantom limb way, but also in a real way. And also, as many people do, love New Orleans deeply, in part because it is, in some ways, you know, people say it's the most European of cities, true. It's the most African of cities, true. But it's also the most American of American cities, because everybody has come through New Orleans, right? It is the site, you know, the ground in so many ways of the ravages of the slave trade, but it is the most multicultural, multilingual. Even to this day, new populations are coming in. And so, you know, it's this place which feels so beautifully cosmopolitan, and also it tells the story of the country.
Remember, the book festival is free, and these are only a few of the great voices who will be on hand next weekend. Have fun. Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. On Saturday, March 9th, from 10:30 a.m. to 3 p.m., the Friends of the New Orleans Public Library sponsor the City Archives Gen Fest at the Main Library on Loyola Avenue. This free event features representatives of Southeastern Louisiana genealogical, preservation, and cultural groups, along with presentations by local experts and scholars. Panelists include representatives from the Louisiana chapter of African American Genealogical and Historical Society, La Creole, Los Isleños, the Museum of the Southern Jewish Experience, Archives of the Archdiocese of New Orleans, Lara Plantation, German Acadian Coast Historical and Genealogical Society, and more. The Friends of the Public Library will be on hand with nearly 1,000 used genealogy books for sale. From how-to books on research and documentation to individual family trees from around the country. Come take a look and see if you find an ancestor. Ellen Ann Fentress discusses her book, The Steps We Take, a memoir of Southern reckoning, with Katie Simpson Smith, Saturday, March 9th from 3:30 to 5 at Octavia Books. Ginger Coe and Stephanie Russell are the featured readers in the Splice Poetry Series, Saturday, March 9th at 6 at the Saturn Bar. Bethany Baptiste, author of The Poisons We Drink, appears in conversation with Brittany Ann Williams and signs books, Monday, March 11th at 6 at Baldwin & Company. Register soon, space is limited. Paul Alexander signs his book Bitter Crop, The Heartache and Triumph of Billie Holiday's Last Year, and appears in conversation with Grammy Award-winning producer Scott Billington, Wednesday, March 13th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Victoria Edwards, the second oldest child of Louisiana Governor Edwin Edwards, discusses her book The Life and Times of a Governor's Daughter, Thursday, March 14th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Silent Book Club meets Friday, March 15th at 6 at Blue Cypress Books. And get ready for Festival Month. The New Orleans Book Festival at Tulane University opens Thursday, March 14th, with a session partnering with The Atlantic, and runs through March 16th. The festival is free, and attendees can register and find the complete schedule at bookfest.tulane.edu. Additional authors, illustrators, and panelists attending include Ken Auletta, Donna Brazile, James Carville, Liz Cheney, Maureen Dowd, Ronan Farrow, Ayana Mathis, Terry McMillan, Helen Molesworth, Viet Thanh Nguyen, Michelle Norris, Lawrence O'Donnell, General David Petraeus, Tracy K. Smith, Hal Raines, Heather Cox Richardson, Nicole Ritchie, Mona Lisa Saloy, Jim Sciutto, David Shipley, Jake Tapper, Cleo Wade, Jesmyn Ward, and Jacob Weisberg. Family Day at the festival takes place from 10 to 2 on Saturday, March 16th at the Avron B. Fogelman Arena in the Devlin Fieldhouse. Then, coming up March 20th to 38th, Tennessee Williams and New Orleans Literary Festival gets underway and runs through March 24th. The Fame Shouting Contest starts earlier this year, Sunday, March 17th at 2 in Jackson Square, and then opening night, March 20th, features a night of burlesque. Check out TennesseeWilliams.net for complete information. And don't forget Saints and Sinners, the LGBTQ literary festival that takes place the same weekend. Check out sasfest.org and have fun. Founding support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, with major support from Rouse's Markets. Additional support comes from the Hellis Foundation, the Jefferson Parish Public Library, and the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities, the state affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in The Reading Life do not necessarily represent those of the National Endowment for the Humanities. The theme song for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by George Ingmeyer and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at WWNO.org. And you can email us at thereadinglife@WWNO.org.